So nice to have you back, Larry.
Good to be with you, Naaman.
And let's get started with what's going on right now between Israelis and Hezbollah. And we've learned that there are various bombings, this new type of bombings, pager bombings.
Yeah. And
what's your take on this? Do you think Israel is trying to, is Israel trying to escalate this situation, or they're just retaliating from what has happened to them?
A little background, I think, is necessary, and you probably know this background, but maybe your listeners don't. There's a real battle going on right now in Jerusalem, and the battle is between some very key figures. Yoav Gallant, for example, Bibi Netanyahu himself, of course, is at the center of the struggle, Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, who are very eager to continue what they're doing, which is finishing off the West Bank and starting on Gaza in terms of settlements. And the turmoil between the IDF leadership and its view of what's happening in Gaza, what's happening indeed to the Israeli Defense Force itself, and what might happen were Hezbollah to enter the fray in a significant way, either on their own or caused by Netanyahu's actions, and to a certain extent, what just developed with the capabilities of the Houthis in Yemen to hit Tel Aviv and cause major destruction, and to do so without any interference by any Israeli, or, this is important, any U.S. defense system, because we have ships with the latest Aegis type and other means, air defenses on them, that are supposed to be the latest stage of the art all around Israel, and all fail to stop this Houthi missile. There's a real turmoil in Israel right now caused by all of this, plus Netanyahu's political problems. And so you look at anything like this strike on the pagers, if you will, and it did do some damage. I understand it may have killed 12 or 13 people and injured others and maybe affected as many as 1,000 of Hezbollah's operatives, and in a significant way that damages that what was their principal communications means. Now, they have plenty of backups, I'm sure. But is this an attempt to get them to do something to escalate and then give Netanyahu his ultimate reason to do things? I don't know, because complicating this, and I've gotten further word on this, the two visits by the Central Command commander, General Cyrillo, essentially were, and the second one was to reemphasize what the first one apparently didn't catch, it didn't register with Netanyahu, and that was that the United States and withdrawal of Theodore Roosevelt and some other moves we've made militarily emphasizes this, isn't going to be with you. That's what I'm hearing. That could be inaccurate, but that's what I'm hearing. So Bibi's got a real decision here to make. The decision, of course, is going to be based on the same criteria he's always used. What'll keep me in power? What'll keep my coalition together? Because that's absolutely necessary to keep me in power. And do I dare do these things I want to do to shake up the IDF and essentially put a leadership in the IDF that'll be a yes man leadership? Because right now, the chief of staff, the IDF, is anything but a yes man, and that's whom he wants to get rid of. That would probably cause dissension in the ranks of the IDF, major dissension in the ranks of the IDF, because most of them agree with him, agree with their chief of staff, whom Netanyahu wants to fire. So Netanyahu is sort of poised right now to really cause major problems, if he hasn't already done so, to the extent that he can't get out of them, that he can't get out of. Just to wait and see what's going to happen. His tendency is to escalate when that occurs. And so that's worrisome. That's very, very worrisome. One of the other things the Central Command commander told him, and rightfully so in my view, and I'm told Lloyd Austin personally told the Central Command commander to tell him this, you start a war with Iran, you're on your own too. Those are very different and powerful words, I think. Very late in coming in this tragic genocide, but nonetheless, words that are powerful and probably will be influential.
Yeah. How did you find the attack of Houthis using a ballistic missile? Just a single ballistic missile just hitting the target. And
yeah, very interesting. And I mean, its speed was what gave it its invulnerability, I think, just from the reports I've heard. Its accuracy was quite demonstrative. I think it's like when Hezbollah hit the 8200 unit. We don't know because Israel put a freeze on all the information. But what I'm hearing is they killed some people in the 8200 unit. And that's one reason Netanyahu conducted the very ineffectual but demonstrative 800 plane strike, because he had to do something. I mean, they actually penetrated a very sacred regime, if you will, and killed some people. So the Houthis are showing what they can do. And someone asked me this morning, where did they get that? And I said, well, look at what Russia and China are giving to Iran, and look at what Iran is giving to the Houthis. It's not too hard to figure out the chain here. I think the only ultimate question is, was it China that provided the technology? Was it Russia that provided the technology? Or was it Iran on its own? We found when we were doing the Axis of Evil for George W. Bush, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq at the time, we found that the Iranians had some really sophisticated people working on their missile business. And it was they were doing a lot of it indigenously. They were become very competent. Now, they got a lot of training and help from the North Koreans. So there was some validity to George W. Bush declaring an axis of evil. They all were colluding. And the North Koreans and the Iranians were colluding probably most of all in terms of missile technology and in terms of how to do things underground deeply enough so that American bombing would not be that effective against it.
In your opinion, can we have any sort of estimation on how many missiles do they have, Houthis? I'm talking about Houthis.
Right.
And how, because it's not, did they produce them on their soil? The technology went there, they produced them on their soil, or it was prepared? And because it's not possible to transport something like this to Yemen. Yeah.
I've heard both things. I've heard that, you know, we have a blockade that tries to stop all Iranian ships, and we try to stop ships we think are suspect in some other way. It's not a not a true blockade, but it certainly has elements of that. And we didn't intercept a ship with that kind of weapon on it, that kind of system on it. Could it have come in by air? Could it have come in a way that we missed? Yes, it possibly could. Or could they have, and I've heard both angles here, could they have been given the what we would call the tech data package, the technical data package, and built it themselves? And what came into them, and this is what we saw in the AQ Khan nuclear network when we were trying to break that up, pieces came together. You know, the Germans provided this. The Hungarians provided this, the Japanese provided this. And often when I say these countries' names, they didn't know they were providing it because it was a piece of material that was dual use, we called it, or in some cases, triple use. Magnets, for example, could have been used for a number of other applications in high energy development fields and in high steel work. And yet they were components of a nuclear weapon if you put them in the right place. So that could be happening. They could have established. I'm sure Iran probably learned something from the Iraqis if the Iraqis didn't learn it from the Iranians during their little war between themselves, how to build these companies, these spider companies, we call them, because you look at a chart and you see a fourth tier company, a third tier company, a second tier company, and a first tier company, the first tier company being back in Yemen or back in Iraq or back in Iran. And you buy things out here with this four-tier company that no sanctions are impacting. And it buys a little component here. Then you get a third-tier company that no sanctions impact, and you buy another component. And by the time you get to the origin, you have the full component you need for the weaponry you want. That's one way Iran has been somewhat keeping up with its aircraft maintenance, because they're so old and we've had sanctions on them for so long that the Tomcats, for example, they have 14s, will hardly fly. But there are ways to get around this. And the Houthis are probably taking advantage of all the Iranians, the Chinese, and the Russians have learned about getting around American sanctions and getting equipment that shouldn't be going to a point going there.
And in your opinion right now in Israel, if they look at this position that they're in right now, you look at Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, Iraqis, Iranians.
A lot of enemies.
And they want, you know what doesn't make sense to me? That they want, these people are the ones who want to escalate the situation. And it doesn't seem that after these assassinations, we haven't seen so far any sort of significant attack on Israel. And the problem is they're thinking that by escalating the situation, they can have some sort of advantage on them. But it doesn't seem to be the case for them.
Well, first of all, Iran has not effected the major reprisal yet. And it will. Take my word for it. They are not in any hurry. They want to make sure there's a 90%+ chance it will succeed. And whether it's assassinating Bibi Netanyahu's son, his wife, Bibi himself, or whatever else act they have planned, they will carry it out eventually. That's the first point. Second point, I'm not sure that Hezbollah really wants to destroy Israel. Now, let me clarify that a bit. I think Israel is on the ropes so dramatically right now that if Hezbollah were to attack full force, it wouldn't even be a suicide attack. There'd be plenty of Hezbollah left afterwards if the United States does not enter the fray in a major way. If Hezbollah were to attack, Israel would be finished. It'd be finished militarily. It'd be finished as a state. It would find it very difficult to pick up the pieces afterwards, and many of its citizens would leave. They would simply evacuate. But Hezbollah doesn't want to do that. And there are a number of reasons for this. One, Hezbollah wants to continue to exist. Were it to do something like that, the results might be resounding for it as well as for Israel. And it also wants to continue to be a part of the political apparatus of Lebanon. Were it to do something like that, that might endanger that because of the damage in the process of doing it Israel would do to Lebanon. Finished off the state of Lebanon for all practical purposes. So Hezbollah has a real significant reason that has nothing to do with this conflict in and of itself, because I'm sure they'd love to finish off Israel if they could. That doesn't have anything to do with the conflict. It's an existential reason for Hezbollah to not become involved unless it absolutely becomes desperate and has to. The Houthis, on the other hand, have opened another front. And frankly, I don't think they have a concern in the world about it. They don't care if Israel flies all its airplanes down there, drops bombs and everything else. They've taken on the Saudis. They've taken on Little Sparta, the Arab Emirates. They've taken on the region, really, the United States, backing them all throughout this. And they've won, essentially. It's a stalemate, really. But for them, that's a victory. So they don't care. So this is a really torturous situation for Israel. And I think the military, the leadership of the military, never fault the leadership of the IDF. That's a rule on my part because they're pretty smart. They know they're in very perilous circumstances. They know they haven't beaten Hamas. They know they aren't going to beat Hamas. They see a prime minister directing them who has lost all control over military logic. They don't know what to do about that, but they could come apart just internally because of this concern. And they see the possibility of escalation. And they see the possibility that I just described of Israel ceasing to exist as an entity that is a state and in that region and prospering and certainly not safe. And that will drive so many people away from Israel that it won't even look like a state afterwards. And even if it is a state, it won't be a liberal democracy. It'll be an apartheid state, clearly an apartheid state, and an apartheid state that has executed genocide. And that has still got to roll down the road. the ramifications of the international condemnation of Israel and the finding of it guilty of suicide, those have still got to roll down the road. No matter what Netanyahu does, no matter what Israel does, they're still going to have an impact. So Israel's in a very parlous situation right now. There are some people around Israel. I'm not sure I would include all of Tehran's leadership in this. I certainly wouldn't include the new president. I think he's voicing some very staunch opposition to what's coming from Iran and trying to adulterate it if he can, or at least make it less powerful than they're planning on it being. And he's in a fight with the Guardian Council, the IRGC, and the others who are in favor of a really harsh retaliation and taking it in cold revenge rather than hot revenge. So you've got all these different power centers playing in this. And at the same time, you've got the United States embroiled in Ukraine in a way that is unfolding before the election takes place. Ukraine is thoroughly and completely defeated now. And it shouldn't have happened before the election. That's the reason now the Defense Department has taken over Ukraine policy. Blinken's out. He's out. He's no longer speaking Ukraine policy. He can pontificate all he wants all over the world. It's not going to make any difference because the Pentagon's in charge. That's why you saw Biden so angry when he met with the British Prime Minister, and the British Prime Minister had his goods and his plans and his attack logos and everything, and Biden had to tell him no, had to say, we're not doing that. Because Putin said, you want to see my highest velocity conventional warhead missiles, which have the impact of a 2 or 3 KT nuclear weapon, but are not nuclear, hit your cities, London, maybe Paris, maybe Berlin, maybe NATO facilities elsewhere, and certainly Washington. Keep going. So we finally understood Putin's rhetoric. We understood his clarity and his precision. And now we're at a sort of a stasis point because Ukraine is defeated. Zelensky needs to go. We need to start some sort of peace talks. We need a ceasefire first, but we can't do it before the election. That's what people are saying. That's what the Democratic Party is saying in particular. So we're in a real Washington, in a place devised of our own doing, in a very dangerous situation right now. And our ostensible allies in Ukraine are thoroughly defeated, and our allies in the Levant are about to be defeated, if not already defeated, and they've done it to themselves largely, but with a lot of help from some interested people around, including the Houthis. And this is not a good situation for a pre-election time frame. Not a good situation at all. I would not want to be the Democrats trying to maintain their sobriety up to the election in November.
I want to talk about what's going on in Ukraine. But before going there, Larry, in the conflict in the Middle East, do you think, you talk about the new president of Iran, he is willing to talk with the United States. And how do you think that if the United States directly talk with Iranians, that would be possible to bring some sort of sanity, some sort of a better situation to the conflict between Israel and Gazans? Because these are two major players in this conflict. And I think they have a lot of influence on the groups involved in this conflict. That's why they can put some sort of pressure on these groups to make some sort of deal.
You just put your finger on a huge deficit right now for Washington. We have no diplomats, including the president of the United States. As I've said many times before, Bill Burns is the only diplomat we have, and he's off trying to negotiate a ceasefire that Netanyahu kills every time it comes up, and cessation to the hostilities that Netanyahu absolutely will not permit. If we had diplomats, if we had a diplomatic corps who knew what it was doing and a president who knew how to generally direct it accordingly, you're right. We probably could start some talks with Iran, probably secret at first, using the Sultan in Oman, for example, wherever, I'm sure we've got some new channels now, whether it's the Qataris or the Emiratis or whatever. We probably have lots of channels to talk through now, the Egyptians. But I don't think we're going to do it because we don't have the finesse. We don't have the capability. We don't have the interest. We don't have the objectives to do that. We have sold our soul to the military instrument. And in the cases I just described of Ukraine, with Austin having taken over policy there, it's positive. But it got to be positive because of the dispositive and negatives that led us there. And that was mainly a void of diplomacy. We have no diplomats, including the president. But if we did, yes, I could see that we could work as we did with previous Iranian regimes. And Obama and John Kerry, I never liked John Kerry much, but I have to admit this, very masterfully did. But they had Zarif to help them on the other side. And Zarif is still there. You know, he's in the wings, if you will. It could be brought out at any time. If we had that caliber of diplomat in Iran and the president, as you suggested, who is inclined this way, and we had that in Washington and maybe a couple of supporting countries, I won't say Britain, I've given up on Britain, they have no diplomats either. We could probably do something. We could start talks again that would not only lead ultimately, possibly, to a new nuclear agreement, but would also lead to, as you said, the immediate assistance in quelling the problems on the West Bank and Gaza with the Houthis and elsewhere, and even now Iraq, and bring some people into some sort of, you know, temporary security arrangement, maybe, that would assure Israel of at least a reasonable future and set an end to the hostilities, getting rid of Netanyahu, help them, get them to a point where they can get rid of Netanyahu, and with him, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and the rest of that complement, because they're what's contaminating Israel right now. Granted, 42% of Israelis supporting them is not a good thing either, but get rid of them, change the entire political complexion in Jerusalem, and you might have a point there. You might be able to work out a regional agreement that satisfies everyone. We're back again to what maybe preceded the October 7th events, when the Saudis and others were willing to deal with Israel. We might be back to some point like that. And we might resurrect Israel as a state in that regard, as long as there is some kind of accommodation of Palestinian interests. Got to be. I don't think it's two states. I think the only solution would be a true liberal democracy. And it would start out with a Jewish prime minister, and it would be like the current Israel, except it would accept its citizens as first-class citizens and accept the right of return and accept the fact that as a liberal democracy, it would one day have a Palestinian majority, a one-state solution, in other words. I know that sounds like pie in the sky, but I could see that, with exquisite diplomacy being exercised on all the parts of which we just described, from Tehran to Washington to Riyadh to Jerusalem and elsewhere, and stop this killing.
Yeah, I think the deal that Chinese, maybe together with Russians, could cut between Iran and Saudi Arabia would hugely benefit any sort of attempt on the part of the United States.
Listen to this from this is from this webinar this morning, but it spun me off into some other things. It spun me off into Jin Shuang, who is the Chinese deputy perm rep at the UN, and his lecturing of the UN Security Council, lecturing them about how China was not interested in killing people. China was interested in peace. Most of all, China was interested in peace quickly and solidly and successfully in the heart of Europe, in Ukraine. And then listening to Chen Gang, the new PRC foreign minister, who said, this is what he said. I checked the translation. This is a quote. U.S. so-called competition is total containment or suppression. If the U.S. doesn't hit the brakes, no amount of guardrails can prevent a crash. That's telling us, right in the face, that's telling us. Are you still with me?
Yeah, Yeah.
Yeah, you still got me. You went off the screen for a second. I thought
because I wanted to be in the picture.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's two Chinese diplomats, very qualified, highly qualified diplomats, telling us what is. And I hark back to Kevin Rudd's words this morning on the webinar. 60% of the economic activity of consequence in the world takes place in East Asia. Half of the population of the world lives in East Asia. That half of the world, that 60% of the economic activity, GDP, however you measure it, is telling us you're broken, fix it quickly. Otherwise, we'll fix it for you. Unmistakably.
Yeah. Two concepts, Larry, two concepts right now. Putin responded to any sort of escalation, as you mentioned, from Ukrainians, if they sent long-range missiles to Ukraine. And if Ukraine tries again to attack these nuclear power plants. And Putin said that we're going to respond. And he was so serious about what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And as serious as he was before this conflict in Ukraine started, if you remember those days, everybody in the mainstream media was like, he's joking. He's not capable of doing anything. Even with his forces inside Ukraine, they were claiming that, no, it's just he's not going to do anything. And right now, it seems to me, do you think that they're taking Putin serious right now, or they're just considering the same type of concept that they had before this conflict started?
Well, certainly much to the consternation of the British Prime Minister, Joe Biden took him seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm told Biden was furious. He was absolutely furious. He was furious at the fact that he had to take him seriously. And that counsel came from the Pentagon. And he was furious at the fact that Sturmer insisted anyway on taking out his maps and everything. So he was hoist between two, you know, I hate this and I hate this, but I've got to do it all. And another thing Putin said, I thought was very descriptive. I checked with a couple of people who are Russian speakers to make sure I got the translation. Putin called Ukraine a private military company fighting for Western interests in the heart of Europe. He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. They're not a country. Zelensky's not the president of a country. They're a private military company hosting all manner of NATO countries fighting in the heart of Europe against Russian interests. That's what they are. He's absolutely right. And to strike as he did, that one installation with that high-speed missile that did some real damage, I'm told that those were the first major Swedish casualties in 75 years in combat. And Sweden is now reconsidering its situation with regard to Ukraine, because that's pretty high casualties for a country like that. You know, you go back to my words, I knew what we were doing in the early 2000s. I got a bug flying around here. We orchestrated the elections in Finland, Norway, and Sweden. We orchestrated them to get our candidate, just as we orchestrated the election of Jens Stoltenberg to be NATO Secretary General. And I'm told we've negotiated the Dutch one who's going to take over. but that's just par for the course for us. NATO is our fiefdom. NATO is our play box. The bulk of the populations, I would say in all three of those countries, Finland, Norway, and Sweden, 57 to 60% of the country did not want to abandon neutrality, but they got through their electoral process, governments that did. So this is, again, the beginning of the northern tier's unraveling of NATO, this ponderous creature we've made of 32 countries. Turkey's, I think, gone. Turkey's unanchored the southern flank completely. They're gone. We're going to see the northern tier begin to unravel, too, if we keep up with casualties like this, and they're going to start thinking about what they've done. The Germans have indicated in their recent vote that they're thinking seriously about what we've done, which is why Putin offered them gas again. And I think the French have indicated that they're thinking about it too, although their resolution of it's a little more muddy, with Macron still being the president and, you know, finally getting a prime minister. But it's still, NATO's not looking healthy like it was supposed to look with this opposition to Putin. It's looking unhealthy because of this opposition to Putin. And he didn't have to do a thing other than persevere. That's all he had to do. He's taken quite a few casualties in that perseverance, a couple of hundred thousand, I'm told. But the Ukrainians have been destroyed. They have been destroyed. They are no longer a viable military force. They are broken.
What was so interesting lately was the, I don't know if you saw, if you watched the two Russian pranksters talking with Sikorsky. And he, no. Sikorsky, the foreign minister of Poland, and he was talking about in this, they were pretending that he was pretending, the Russian prankster was pretending that he is Poroshenko, and he's talking to Sikorsky, and Sikorsky was just explaining everything. But what was so positive about this talk, that we've learned that NATO has no intention to interfere, to escalate the situation with the conflict in Ukraine. He said that they're not going to be there. They're not going to put troops on the ground to fight for Ukraine. And the other thing that was
let me just say that I think that's a uniquely Polish point of view right now that is getting out. It's getting out to others. But Poland, to a certain extent, in its more sane regions, and by that I mean sectors of society, has always had some reservations about this. They haven't made their way out into the public as much as they would have otherwise because of the government's inclination to stanch them. But they've always been concerned about it. I have a lot of Polish friends who email me various times, and there's been significant concern about Ukraine and about what they were doing with regard to Ukraine, and incidentally, what they were doing with regard to hosting U.S. forces. Because they saw them initially as a buttress of their own security. And then as Ukraine devolved into a mess, they saw them as a detriment to their own security. So there's always been a lot of contention in Poland about whether this was a good move or not. And I think that's seeping out into other NATO countries now, just as I indicated, for different reasons, but nonetheless, it's seeping out.
Yeah, it's a major change, Larry, if you remember when this conflict started, how Poland was talking about the conflict. And right now they're talking this way. It's so positive, in my opinion.
Well, here again, you've got the government. You know, the government was speaking one thing, and the people were thinking, at least a significant portion of the people were thinking another thing. After all, they've, you know, they've got memories. And they've got grandpas and grandmothers and uncles and aunts that have memories. And they know how dangerous it is to start something in the heart of Europe the way we have and to be completely ignorant of how badly you're losing. Yeah. Or that's what it appeared to them like. I still have a problem with guys like Blinken and Sullivan and Biden even. Not having a more of an inclination to understand how badly they're losing. But I that look on Biden's face when he was with the British Prime Minister told me that this was a complete surprise to old Joe. How can you be commander in chief of the armed forces of the United States who are engaged in a conflict where we are losing badly and not feel it? Not know it, not understand it, unless you're totally out of it. And I have to conclude that Biden is totally out of it. And I have to conclude also that his advisors are brain dead, Blinken and Sullivan in particular.
And the other point in what Sikorsky was talking about was the Ukrainian entry to the European Union, into the European Union, that would be in the next 10 years, 20 years, which
that's pure self-interest on the part of the Poles.
And he said, we waited more than 10 years to be part of the European Union. And you have to prepare for that. You cannot be part of the European before being prepared?
Well, look at what we did. We did, you know, I'm not a NATO soldier. My whole 31 years, my foreign service was in the Pacific. But when I was a professor at the Naval War College, I made a couple of trips to Europe to sort of get the sense of the place for what I was teaching in the seminars at the Naval War College. And I'd been to Europe many, many times, 30, 40 times privately. What I sensed about NATO at that particular time, as they began to go into this incredible expansion period, was that they didn't know what they were doing. And then all of a sudden, I did a little more study and analysis, and I realized they did know what they were doing. And what they were doing was pushing aside all the requirements for democracy, all the requirements for justice systems that worked, basically, all the requirements for not having a criminal activity that was, you know, surpassing everything else in the world. Montenegro, the automobile capital theft of the world, many of the others, people trafficking in people capitals, Albania, you know, they just waived everything. All the requirements to be members of NATO that were what you might call the requirements for a fundamentally liberal democracy were waived. And we took all these people in, and I said, whoa, this is untenable. We must be doing this for some other reason than security. Wasn't that simple, wasn't that basic, but I mean, and yes, we were. We were doing it for money. We were doing it for money. Lockheed Martin wanted to sell F-16s to Poland. Lockheed Martin wanted to sell F-35s to all manner of other countries. Lockheed Martin wanted to do this. Raytheon wanted to do this, now a part of Lockheed Martin. You know, it was all about money, and it was all about military defense contractors and the so-called military industrial complex having so much enormous impact and influence on not just the Congress, where it's undisputed that they have it, but also on the chief executive, on the president of the United States and his staff and his counselors. They have an enormous influence. And then you got to count into it also the fact that we had some really, I think, flagrantly irresponsible flag officers, admirals and generals, who were saying that this was great. This was great. Not even thinking about what it meant to give an Article 5 agreement, an attack on one is an attack on all, our nuclear umbrella is over you, to countries like Albania and Montenegro, and for that matter, even Poland. I love the Poles, I love Poland, but it is the stomping ground of empires for over 1,000 years. Do you want to incorporate that in an alliance that has nuclear weapons poised to be used in defense of it? I think not, but we did. It made no sense to me at the time as a soldier. It made no sense to me as a diplomat. But we did it. And then when I saw how we did it and why we did it, it really bothered me because I knew it would come crashing down around our ears.
Larry, when you look at what's going on in Ukraine and you see the future of this conflict in terms of what's going on in the United States, in my opinion, whoever wins the 2024 presidential election would be different from what Joe Biden has been during this conflict, because none of them are interested, in my opinion, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, none of them is interested in what's going on in Ukraine. And many people are arguing maybe Kamala would continue. I don't believe that she would do that. She would put an end to this conflict because she knows that the policy that the Biden administration has been implementing in Ukraine doesn't work.
I think you're right. I don't know what I base that on. Maybe intuition is all I could say, but I think you're right. And I think you're right for political instinct reasons as much as personal or compassionate reasons. I think the same thing about Gaza. But here's the problem, Nima. We are probably going to have, if polls are right now, and if people commenting on those polls are right now, we are going to have a very razor-thin margin of victory in November. And if that's the case, we are going to have a real contest between November and January the 20th or whenever to decide who's going to be the president and to have an inauguration that is not impacted by a revolution of sorts. And that could change all the bets. But I do think if that sort of situation eventuates, you're going to find whoever is ultimately the president getting out of these foreign entanglements as fast as they possibly can.
Yeah. Here comes the other part of this conflict would be what Zelensky and his administration or what they're planning for and what's in their mind right now, because they should know what's going on in the United States.
Yeah.
And what would be the future for them? And as soon as possible, they can get any sort of negotiations with Russians, I think would be in their benefit.
You're absolutely right, I think. I don't know if Zelensky feels that way anymore. I once thought he had some sense, but of late I've watched him and I don't think he's got any sense. Not any sense of gravitas and how perilous his situation is right now. I'm just so thankful, really thankful, that the Russians did not leave nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Very thankful. That was a real foresight not to leave them there. I no doubt in my mind, Zelensky would be hurling those nuclear weapons at Moscow, and we'd be in a nuclear war post-haste. What does he do now if he does come to his senses is, I would say, go to your Dasha as safely and as quickly as you can, wherever it might be. I understand he's got several set up, and let elections take place in Kyiv and across Ukraine, such as it is. And let a new government be established and let that government be legitimate for the first time in a long time. Then undeclare martial law, lift the martial law, and then tell Putin you want to talk. I'll do it all at the same time, basically. And end this thing and end it on some kind of equitable basis so that Ukraine does have some territory left, does have a port in Odessa, does have the bulk of its country remaining. And maybe in the negotiations, you can work out a deal whereby you have some sort of referenda eventually in the easternmost oblast. And guess what? I think if you waited a decent interval, you'd probably find those oblasts voting to be affiliated with Russia, just as you did in Ukraine, Crimea. The vote there was overwhelming that they wanted to stay affiliated with Russia rather than Ukraine. So that's a solution. And then after that, neutrality, neutrality, neutrality. Neutrality in the heart of Europe is not a bad thing. Take a lesson from Switzerland.
I think both sides can help Ukraine to reconstruct. Russia is willing to do that. European Union would be interested in doing that. The United States. And it depends on what's going on in Ukraine in terms of their administration and how they want to manage the situation.
Everybody, including China, wants to get in there and rape, pillage, and plunder Ukraine. Washington wants to, London wants to, Paris wants to. Ukraine has got a lot of assets, as Lindsey Graham so undiplomatically said on the floor of the United States Congress the other day. They got lots of things we need. Right, Lindsey. Got lots of things the world needs. China, that 16-hour railroad, 16 hours to get from China's Pacific ports into the heart of Europe. It's just raring to go. And, you know, that's one reason I think we're doing Ukraine. I think that is one of the significant reasons Washington is holding on in Ukraine, is because they don't want to see China get that going. That's an incredible change for China with one of the largest groups of people with money in the world, Europe, you know. $23 trillion GDP, the equivalent of our own GDP, if you put all 740 some odd millions of them together. They want in there. China wants in there. That's what that guy was talking about. We're for competition. We're for economic competition. We're not for war. And we're going to beat the hell out of you. Well, that's one reason we don't fight fair. We just do not fight fair. You know, that's what the Chinese were saying. You don't fight fair. Well, they don't fight fair either. Not really. They do a lot of things behind the scenes, of course. But let's do the things behind the scenes that don't cause people to die and don't cause mothers to go home crying. and don't cause battlefields and wars. If we can't, if the United States cannot compete with China on an economic and financial and trade basis, let's go home. We don't deserve to be in the world.
And in terms of negotiations for Ukraine, it's going to be definitely between the United States and Russia. Yeah. Ukraine could be part of this, but it's not substantial in these type of negotiations. I think Russia wants the United States to give some sort of, you can, from now on, we are accepting everything on this treaty, and we're going to guarantee that nothing going to happen in terms of what's going on in Ukraine. I think Russia would demand that.
I think so too, and I go back to your previous comments, which I think were accurate. It's going to take a new administration that doesn't feel so much like it's eating crow, because the Biden administration has walked itself out on a plank over a deep blue sea, and the plank is being sawed behind it by Moscow. And so it couldn't possibly do that. It couldn't possibly do that. We need a new administration that's looking at it with no blinders and looking at it from the perspective that the Chinese deputy perm rep at the UN Security Council said, from the perspective of ending the war and healing Europe.
I think that would, especially Germany would benefit from this talk.
Yes.
Right. Yes. Now, Germany is in real trouble. Their economy is just getting devastated.
And look at what we did. Look at what we did. We blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, okay? We blew up the damn pipeline. Let's admit it. We blew up the pipeline. We also, our Congress and our president, canceled the East Coast pipeline in the United States of America that was being built by my energy company, Dominion Virginia Power, one of the best companies on the East Coast, second only to Duke Power, probably the most powerful on the East Coast. They canceled it. Why did the Congress say it canceled it? Because Dominion planned on the first decade or so of production of those methane pipelines going to Europe, being sold to Europe. How strategically stupid was that of the United States? We could be supplying the Germans with methane if we had not canceled that pipeline. But what we did was blow up the other one. Insane. I mean, that's the way, that's what the Chinese said. That's what the new foreign minister said. That's our policy in the world, is to be bloody-minded, undercover, secretive, stupid, violative of every international accord we ever set up and said we believed in. Look at Gaza, if you want an example. And, you know, as he said, we're coming, if we don't hit the brakes, there are no amount of guardrails that can prevent our crash. He's right. You don't go and blow up somebody's pipeline that's supplying gas to a hungry Germany and then not provide an alternative. I mean, we had an alternative. Provide it before you blow up their pipeline. You know, compete with them. That's what it's called, competition, legitimate competition.
Larry, just to wrap up this session, right now in the European Union, we have a lot of, because we have Serbia that is not happy with the situation they're in right now because they wanted to be part of European Union. They couldn't be. And they were talking about being part of BRICS. And this division between the eastern and western part of Europe, I think it's a poison for the future of European countries in terms of, because it's an outcome of what's going on in Ukraine. But do you understand, do you feel that European Union, I'm talking about all these countries, are they trying to understand each other's position right now, toward what's going on in Ukraine? Because there has to be some sort of understanding to come out with a solution to what's going on in the European Union vis-a-vis what's going on in Ukraine.
Nima, I think it's more fundamental than even what you just described. I think what you just described is the face of current events. The fundamental nature is the distaste that Europe had for a Muslim country. And Erdogan is finally coming to realize that that is the fundamental reason that Turkey could not be a member of the European Union. That makes it far more serious. Far more serious. You remember Samuel Huntington's theory of the clash of civilizations, and people who later poo-pooed that and said, "No, we're not having that." Well, to a certain extent, Huntington was right. There is this stigma, if you will, in basically white Europe, even though immigration is turning it a little more chocolate, a little different. There is this stigma. And it goes all the way back to when, you know, the Moors almost took Europe and got stopped only as they came out of Spain and into France. But it's an age-old animosity, and it's an animosity electrified now by terrorism, the events since 9/11, the different things that are happening with ISIS-K. And I just read a report where ISIS-K is probably going to attack in the United States within the next 9 months or so, and certainly has already attacked in Europe. I think it's fundamental, and I think the Turkish nation has sort of absorbed that fundamental schism. And it's dangerous. It's dangerous. It's very dangerous, because it means that a line is going to go down. And on that side of the line is China, Turkey, India, and other countries, which, as Kevin Rudd said, comprise 60% of the world's economic activity and half or better of its population, and the other side, which is, I think, inarguably in decline. It can resurrect itself. It can stop its decline. It can level off, if you will. And it can come back to be a reasonable competitor for that half of the world, which China is the engine of course. But it's not making that decision. It's making the decisions to fight it tooth and nail, both racially under the covers and in your face with bombs, bullets, and bayonets. That's not a good way to resolve the problem. That's not a good way to resolve the problem. So you resolve the problem by looking at the future and thinking the climate is going to kill us all. Nuclear weapons are going to kill us all even more immediately. We need to work together. We need to collaborate. We need to cooperate, put these fundamental differences aside. I know they're difficult to put aside, but deal with them as best you can. But these two crises that confront all of humanity must be dealt with, and we can't deal with them unless we do it together.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Take care.
Don't have any of